Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download your iPhone and Android app for the program and the scheduled information and podcast of past programs. I'm Joseph Fink, the President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, California. I'm the former chairman of the club's Board of Governors and your moderator for tonight's program. It's now my pleasure to introduce you to our distinguished speaker. Two-term mayor, legendary speaker of the California State Assembly, and widely regarded as the most influential African-American politician of the late 20th century, Willie L. Brown, Jr., has been at the center of California politics, government, and civic life for an astonishing four decades. His career spans the American presidency from Lyndon Johnson to Barack Obama. He's worked with every California governor from Pat Brown to Jerry Brown, twice. From civic rights to education reform, tax policy, economic development, health care, international trade, domestic partnerships, and affirmative action, he's left his mark on nearly every aspect of politics and public policy in the Golden State. As the mayor of California's most cosmopolitan city, San Francisco, he refurbished and rebuilt the nation's busiest transit system, pioneered the use of bond measures to build affordable housing, created a model juvenile justice system, and paved the way for a second campus of the University of California at San Francisco to serve as an anchor in the new field of development of the burgeoning field of biotechnology. Today he heads the Willie L. Brown Jr. Institute on Politics and Public Service, where this acknowledged master of politics shares his background, skills, and creativity with a new generation of California leaders. Hardly a week goes by when he is not seen on some national television program commenting on some aspect of the American political scene. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Mayor Willie Brown.
Mr. President, thank you kindly for that warm Willie Brown written introduction. You read it as it was written, and I appreciate that. I am delighted to see so many of you, including those that I cannot completely see in the library area. Well, it's the biggest crowd, I think, Joe, that since I've been doing these lectures. I do them once a year, and it's interesting for me to reflect upon what was said last year and what the predictions that were made by me and whether or not any of those predictions have become a reality. And I must tell you that in Major League Baseball, I would be batting more than Ted Williams, retired at batting, in terms of the accuracy, because I said that Barack Obama would win re-election, and he handsomely did against Mr. Romney. And it was obviously a very interesting and thoroughly entertaining experience for some of us to observe what occurred during the course of that election. Because I think for the first time, unlike Mr. Obama's first run, when he kind of pioneered the idea of communicating by way of the internet and by way of all of the electronic devices that you can use to reach and talk to people and communicate with people, he really perfected that operation in the re-election process. And it was incredibly effective. More money was raised than ever been raised by any candidate for public office. Over $1 billion was raised to help elect Mr. Obama to the presidency, and the contributors were literally people making almost no money to people making an unlimited amount of money. and it was just a startling performance by a candidate from public office. And of course, by the time the vote was taken, or he had successfully engineered the greatest amount of respectability and admiration among the voters, something that candidates usually lose during the course of the election, whether they win the election or not. I think Mr. Obama enhanced his presence with people and his acceptance because he appeared to be more available. Now, obviously, there were some wonderful things that happened on Mr. Obama's behalf. For an example, all the Republicans in the world apparently were running, and at some point, each of them caved in. And as they caved in, the process was dictated for the cave-in, in part, by whomever their opponent might happen to be. And in that intermural scrimmage, they really damaged substantially their chances of winning elective office. And then suddenly the economy started to improve, and that created a major problem for them. And of course, the credentialing of taking out bin Laden and a few other things of that nature had served Mr. Obama well, and he won handsomely. He did not, however, take with him a sufficient number of people to generate a majority in both houses in the Congress. Ms. Pelosi remains as the Democratic leader rather than the Speaker, a position she occupied prior to the elections of 2010. Harry Reid remained head of the U.S. Senate, but not with anything unusually great in terms of pure numbers, because he still was not in a position to create an opportunity for legitimate issues to be debated. With that crazy rule they have of saying if you can't prove you have 60 votes, you don't even bother to debate the merits of a given issue on the floor, because people will simply talk forever and keep you from having a vote cast. And so the Senate has that crazy business of respecting that concept, and that didn't change. Hopefully it would have changed, but it didn't change in that election. And so we ended up with an interesting contrast to be played out in the early part of Mr. Obama's second term. And you're beginning to see that on a daily basis. When Mr. Obama decided to take on the awesome task of trying to do something about gun control, you notice that practically everybody in America was focused on gun control. There had been enough horrible situations generated by the use of firearms in various places where children had been killed and others had been killed without warning and without any evidence of any cause or any prompting. And so America was energized to do something about gun control. America was energized, but not the U.S. Senate. Now the House of Representatives, you couldn't say that they were part of America if you refer to America in the gross sense of the word, because they obviously didn't get the word. They did not respond, even though Senator Feinstein, our own senator in this state, did her best to generate a great interest. And the results were that gun control is still an issue that's out there that needs to be addressed and needs to be discussed. I have two suggestions that I've made to the Senate and to the President. I said, it's not, when we were concerned about auto safety, we didn't go after the drivers. We had done everything we could to the drivers. We had said, you must be qualified and licensed to drive a car. You must have a certain level of skills to drive a car, or you must not drive a car when you're under the influence of anything that could alter your conduct. Nevertheless, we still had a huge number of people being harmed by virtue of auto accidents. And we looked to see where we could do something seriously about that beyond simply the drivers. And where did we look? We looked to the equipment itself. We looked to see what nature of that equipment could we touch in order to change the results of what happens when that equipment bumps into each other. We decided One thing that could be done was that we could put airbags in cars, and that would thereby offer some level of support to keep you from having to absorb the entirety of whatever the impact might be. We had a requirement for seatbelts, and interestingly enough, we had the insurance industry as well as the consumer industry joined together for the purpose of insisting upon these changes in the making of automobiles. And we even had some manufacturers of automobiles agreeing with that and in fact installing it and making it mandatory and selling cars only with those things in it. And then we also said, we're finding that if you're out there driving a car, that car really ought to have some liability protection for its use, no matter who happens to be using it. So then we imposed upon the public the business of, in fact, having to have every car insured. Otherwise, it cannot be licensed. It cannot be certified as a vehicle to be used upon the road. And you have to carry with you the little certificate that says you are insured. So we did two significant things, or maybe three in that regard. So I said to the administration and to the U.S. Congress, listen, why don't you stop just thinking about doing something with the people who carry the guns and the people who use the guns, because they're pretty well organized. The people who appear not to be organized at all are the people who make the guns. So why don't you turn your attention, and they're allegedly law-abiding people, many of them are corporations, many of them are owned by stockholders. Why don't you require those persons, when they make these weapons, to do something about the nature of the weapons so that they will have some safety provisions in them? You should also say that no gun can be sold to anybody without some insurance on that gun. So suddenly you've got a combination of two things. You've got the nature of the weapons and how they're made and who can use them once they are made, just like you do with automobiles. And now you also have the business that every weapon out there will have some form of liability insurance upon it. Nobody has responded positively to my stroke of genius. I don't understand that, but it seems logical to me. I suspect, however, they have not responded, because the people who actually funded most of the opposition to any change of the gun law are the people who make the guns. It is not the ordinary citizen putting up money to defeat candidates. It's the people who make the guns. And I say, no question in this nation, we would be better off if we addressed the issue from that standpoint. Mr. Obama hasn't yet responded. Maybe he will respond now that he has some other things that are annoying and vexing to him. At one time in this country, if somebody yelled FBI, politicians in particular would become frantic, hoping that those three letters were not referencing them. And you would be the same way. You would, if you had a reason, otherwise it wouldn't bother you at all if FBI, those three letters. But there are three letters that literally creates a crisis in all of us. If someone says, I'm from the IRS, out the back door goes all of us. We instantly disappear, even though we may not have a job, even though we may have no relationship to anything to do with taxes. We just know IRS is a bad word. Little kids know IRS is a bad word. Everybody, it's universal, totally and completely universal. And so, when the IRS decided to do whatever they were doing in Cincinnati about the Tea Party people, or the people who uttered patriotism and desired to have some tax-exempt status bestowed upon them, they began to look closely to see whether or not there was any real eligibility. Well, they did it in a very stupid way. For years, by the way, the IRS has done exactly what they were doing in Cincinnati. They have been selective about people in terms of evaluating whether or not they could do something about you through the IRS process and whether or not you are complying. Years ago, The NAACP and organizations of that nature advocating civil rights were constantly the target of the IRS for evaluation purposes, and the country was not terribly alarmed about that. And it's simply because we didn't have the method of communicating that we now have. On an instant basis, you can know exactly what the IRS is doing or what somebody says they're doing. And the bloggers really make it interesting because they're creating opportunities for the IRS to be vilified, and like they do a lot of other people, but they aren't particular, because anytime you say anything negative about the IRS, instantly it has credibility, no matter who says it. It could be Bin Laden said it, and it would have credibility. That's just how unacceptable the IRS happens to be. Well, lo and behold, it was unacceptable to everybody apparently except our good president, because when they called to his attention that something had occurred on his watch with the IRS, he talked intellectually, as he always does. He is so smart, so brilliant, and so much a professor, I'm sure Joe would have hired him at Dominican if he had had the opportunity, because he is professorial. He does not understand, though, that there are some occasions when you ought to be gutter in your reactions to things like the IRS. You really should call them a sack full of MFs and tell what you're going to do to them when you get the opportunity. But he didn't do that. He waited 2 or 3 days before he became completely outraged. I suspect he was outraged at the outset, but being the controlled presentation and presenter that he really is, he was not going to show that to anybody, because that would have shown something less than the kind of pristine quality that he normally shows. But you know, he's got to learn that on some occasions the pristine quality is to get with the lynch mob and do something about the IRS in some way, one way or another. He didn't do that, and so that was a negative for him. Well, as he was thinking through how his reaction should happen to the IRS, somebody called his attention that his Justice Department had in fact grabbed somebody's cell phone, the records, and grabbed cell phone of the Associated Press. And under the rules, you're supposed to notify them that you're going to get the cell phones. They're not treated like dope dealers, usually. Well, on this occasion, they were treated like dope dealers. You don't tell a dope dealer, I'm listening to what you, your transaction, I'm using, figuring out who you're selling to, I'm figuring out who you're calling. And so with the Associated Press, allegedly, in the interest of trying to figure out where the leak was on a matter of some national security, they did something with the Associated Press that enraged the journalists in this country like never before. And so all of a sudden, not only did he have a problem with the IRS, he had a problem with the press, period, because he didn't react quickly enough to that one either. And so suddenly, this wonderful acceptance quality candidate that received such great accolades in the election that just put him back in the presidency, unprecedented in every way, historical in every way, suddenly he's on the bubble. He's at the center of decisions and comments and questions, and the Republicans are really enjoying it because they desperately need it to divert the attention from their total and complete inadequacies. They demonstrated them in the campaign that they just lost at every level. When Karl Rove and his crowd spent all that money and got nothing in return for it, I don't know why they just didn't steal the money and not bother to try to spend it, because they had no product that they could influence anybody with. But they spent it, and it proven to be an unwise expenditure, and believe me, across the board, it was incredibly damaging. In our own state, they didn't spend any money apparently in the state of California, and so Nancy Pelosi's operation picked up 4 or 5 seats. They changed the way in which people got elected statewide in California. You now are going to have runoffs even if you're unopposed, almost. Simply because nobody can win in a primary anymore. Well, all that in the state of California contributed badly to the Republicans. And then they were wrong on practically every issue, whether it was immigration or whether it was taxes, whether it was the assistance to people, whether it was food stamps, whether it was a farm subsidy. There was not one issue on which the Republicans were on the right side of the issue in the last election. And as a result of all that effort, they really were in the tank. They went right in the tubes. Some Republicans wised up when they saw what was about to happen and immediately changed their stripes. The man in New Jersey, for an example, got a golden opportunity when the Lord brought a storm to that area to do some cleanup and some changes. He joined with Obama and lamented what had occurred. And he praised Obama and he hugged Obama. As a matter of fact, it appears as if he squeezed Obama. In the process, however, it angered lots of Republicans because they were wrong even on those issues. And so the Republicans were really in a great quandary come January 1st of this year. They were really looking around to try to find something to talk about and somewhere to go and how to get one more vote among some people. They knew they'd lost all the immigrants. They knew that they've lost the racial minorities. They've known that they've lost the women's vote. They've known that they've lost the peace vote. They've known that by their position, they've lost the environmental vote. They literally they lost every vote there is except people who pray to the Lord that I'm not familiar with. And so they, and it was just, it was incredibly destructive. And so they start looking for some other things. Well, lo and behold, they now have a series of things that they can talk about and series of things that diverts the attention towards them. They have now said IRS is a good one for them and they're on it. Mr. Miller left, but it's, you know, it's funny. I'm not sure that I would have fired Mr. Miller. In spite of my comments about what Mr. Obama did not do, I think I would have suspended Mr. Miller. And I think I would have suspended him with pay. Now I know some of you say, whoa, why would you do that? You're supposed to, if he's done something wrong. That's right. But we need to determine whether or not he's done something wrong. But we don't need to have him mad at us. Because just think, if Mr. Miller is fired and he goes to testify before the Congress, he may say it was Joe Fink who had me do it, or it was Willie Brown who had me do it, or Barack Obama. He may just lie through his teeth. And the Republicans would love to have him do that because for the next several weeks, the lie would have to be undone by somebody, and it's very difficult to disprove a lie. It's just amazing how difficult it is in this world of politics. And so tactically, having Mr. Miller walk the plank so soon before you had engaged him to make sure that he didn't become a hostile witness and start making stuff up, it just didn't work very well. Well, lo and behold, there's also the whole business of people who want to run in 2016 jumping at the chance or to do something about their potential candidacy among potential voters, and therefore the immigration issue is there. I mean, you got to know the immigration deal is a bad deal. Leahy, Senator, was correct. The vote was, I think, 13-5 out of the Senate, and they put it on the floor, and certainly many of us who are advocates of reforms in the immigration cycle know that movement on the bill is important. But the contents of that bill defies description. And I hope at some point we get away from just the simple Republican politics. There's no justification for Democrats supporting an immigration bill that Republicans would sign on to and the Republicans have written. If the opportunity to do something about immigration, you really ought to do it with real principle and with real long-range implications. This bill is a political fix for candidates for public office in 14 and 16, has almost nothing to do with whether or not you really fix the immigration issue. But our Democrats are gun-shy. They don't want to be in a position where they raise any questions because, lo and behold, the immigration advocates are going to go crazy if they raise any questions because they see some potential for movement. That's all true. But at some point in this world of politics, you've got to apply some aspect or principle to whatever decision you may ultimately make. But the Republicans are enjoying every second of it. And of course, they're adding the Associated Press. It's amazing how the Republicans are defending, trying to, in some fashion, defend it, the business of press attacks in some places and condemn them in other places. But on this one, they're unanimous. If they're outraged, although they have never, ever voted for the Shia law, which would eliminate the possibility that this could occur and eliminate a number of things that's done hostile to the press, they're not there. They are already on a different page, and the press isn't reporting it as accurately as they should, because they should not be allowed to get away with what appears to be a friendly relationship on this issue. Although I saw today where apparently the U.S. government has also tagged Fox once or twice in terms of their cell phones and their private equipment, and maybe that will generate a greater amount of interest than just the Associated Press. And then finally, of course, on the focused attention for the 2016, everybody fears Hillary Clinton. Everybody fears Hillary Clinton. They believe that all she has to do is continue to breathe, and in 2016, she'll be elected to the presidency of the United States. And so they're trying to figure out how to stop her from breathing between now and then, and they're trying to charge her with everything under the sun. And people in the public doesn't care very much, I don't think, about some of the things they're saying about her and what happened in that incident involving the consular office, and with our losing Ambassador Stevens and what have you. They're trying to lay it off on her, but they are being disrupted by their own antics on the press and by their own antics at the IRS. And I'm sure Ms. Clinton, who I can assure you will be a candidate in 2016, if you are lucky enough to hear her when she last appeared here, she'll be appearing again. If she's running in 2016, and when she does, I'm certain that she will win. I do not see any Republican on the scene capable of defeating her, and I think the only question is going to be who's going to run with her. No Democrat is going to be foolish enough, I don't think, to run against her. And so I think that it's just going to be a question of who runs with her. Will it be a Latino? Will it be an African American? Who will be it? Will it be somebody from the South? Will it be somebody from the Middle West? Where will that person come from that will be her running mate that will ensure us a 4 more years of Democratic control? That's kind of my perspective on what is occurring. I know that many of you want the Keystone Pipe discussion. Some of you want one or two other discussions. Some of you may even be interested in what the feds are doing with reference to propping up the economy and keeping it moving. All those interesting subject matters, but they're not as sexy as some of the other things. So you got to be in sight. On the local scene, we are enjoying at an unprecedented level of tranquility among the elected officials. It's hard to tell that we even have a board of supervisors. We know that we have a mayor because we see him almost every day. We see him trying to make sure that the Warriors know that they're welcome at Pier 3032. You see him trying to make sure that the America's Cup actually has at least one opponent for Oracle on the day that that incident is to, in fact, those are the days that it's to take place. And you're watching him in awe as he acknowledges how important the Giants really are, and then to have the Super Bowl handed off to him with a magnificent effort. And I must tell you that it was difficult for me not to show up tonight to celebrate that effort, because I have participated in that. I kept my commitment and come here. But the mayor is over there celebrating another triumph, and I resent that he is able to have that kind of a celebration, because it's one that I always wanted. You recall that I did in my term in 1997, we did an effort among many voters to ask you to allow us to put in $100 million to have a stadium built here for the 49ers. And by about 1,500 votes, you did exactly that. We did not allow recount, and that 1,500 votes stood, and we were ready to go with $100 million of public money, ultimately, to build a stadium. And then Mr. DeBartolo got himself in a little bit of trouble with some governor in Louisiana, and that didn't turn out well for either of them. The governor went to jail, and Mr. DeBartolo lost control of the Niners, and the subsequent owners of the Niners, his sister and her and his brother-in-law, didn't work well with San Francisco, and San Francisco didn't work well with them, and the results were that they moved everything down to Santa Clara. And now we have a stadium coming out of the ground in Santa Clara that is just magnificent in its physical appearance from what I've seen so far. And believe me, we had a Super Bowl promise for 1999. That was a commitment previously made before I became mayor. And Paul Tagliabue, who was then the commissioner, we made an arrangement that if 1997 vote was approved, we would take, we'd forego the 1999 Super Bowl because we had a commitment for one Super Bowl every 5 years thereafter in our new stadium. So I had a good deal arranged. I mean, just a good deal arranged. And DeBartolo screwed it up. And now Ed Lee comes along and gets the 50th anniversary of the Super Bowl, the most important Super Bowl ever, I suspect. And obviously, he's going to have a hell of a good time because that Super Bowl is going to be exactly when he's possibly seeking re-election. And can you imagine if you were a candidate against Ed Lee and all of his comments and all of his appearances and all of his involvement was about this $300 million to $500 million in money that's coming in for the Super Bowl, and hopefully the 49ers are playing in the Super Bowl, and hopefully by then the Warriors will be victorious and in the playoffs again, and if not win in the playoffs, and you know that in another 6, 7, or 8 months, they're going to open this magnificent facility here on the waterfront, which they already designed and are in the process of building. It's just got to be the most pleasurable experience you could have as a mayor, and in particular, since you lost that fight on the sheriff by virtue of some person whom you appointed double-crossing you, you really are in a position where you're in complete rehab. You no longer need therapy at all to deal with whatever problems you may have as a result of that. You're really on a high. You have a board of supervisors that appears to be somewhat cooperative. You have a city attorney who at the moment isn't running against you. You have a whole series of good things going on, and so the city is in great shape. Except from my perspective, I'm a little annoyed, not only because of his great success that I am very much a supporter of. I went to China with him in April for his first visit since being elected mayor. And believe me, he was treated as if he was the president of America rather than just the mayor of San Francisco. And I went to China 3 times. And I never got that kind of treatment. But then it could be a race thing. Who knows? But it was just an incredible experience to be with him on that trip and to see the magnificent, warm reception he received. But my problem is with these 24, 25 cranes you see around town, I occasionally wander around to where they're doing the work. And invariably, I take a look at the cars that bring these workers to the job. I take a look at the people who work in there. And I'm coming away with a distinct impression that they're not San Franciscans. And that really causes me a problem. We have in this city what's called a local hire ordinance. And in that local hire ordinance, efforts are supposed to be made so that unemployed people in San Francisco with skills and ability get the first shot at doing the work that needs to be done. There is a contract that was just let yesterday
for the continuation of the Central Subway. And the Central Subway, you know, has been a thorn in some people's side. It's been a pride and joy of others. It's been a 25-year almost effort to really make it happen. And it's actually occurring. We actually are doing a subway from down near King Street in the station for Caltrain all the way over to about Washington Square, just beyond Chinatown in North Beach. And when that subway starts to move and move people back and forth, it's obviously going to be fabulous. But when I went down to check, I didn't see a soul. It looked like they even shop in San Francisco, let alone live in San Francisco or visit San Francisco. And now that we let the contract for the four stations, I took a look at the content of the contract and the RFP, and there was really no requirement imposed upon the people who won the right to build those stations. And I suspect the same is occurring on the other jobs. So there are things that we need to do. John Avalos, who's been the strongest advocate for local hire, hasn't seemed to follow up the way that you really should follow up to ensure that people who live in this city gets the jobs. Well, there's still some great opportunities out there. We are about to unveil the actual building operation in the Hunters Point Naval Shipyard. Lennar is going to do that. And at some point in the not-too-distant future, the same thing is going to happen on Treasure Island. Each of those are about 3 to 5 year projects. And each of those are projects that I think can be done by people who actually work here. And so I am dedicated to trying to push to make sure that our supervisors, as well as the mayor and those who have the responsibility, begin to take a closer look at who the employees are, because with the number of cranes that we have going here, we ought to be a city where the unemployment rate among local residents ought to be almost zero. And those are really good jobs. I don't know what your experience happens to be these days, but you can't get a contractor to take your call simply because they're so busy. You think you're calling an office of government now. There will be there's no live body anymore. And it used to be the contractors were eager. They'd come out and fight each other in order to give you an estimate and be ready to go to work after they give you that estimate. Now they give you an estimate of the time when they'll come out, not whether or not they will do the work. And that means then that we are extraordinarily busy. That means the city is in just great shape. Every restaurant seems to have a waiting list. Every store seems to have customers shopping, and many of the people may be using PayPal or some other means by which to pay for it, but they are paying. The situation in terms of employment for people in the retail world seems to be working reasonably well, and clearly in the service industry it's working well. But in the industry where there are really great opportunities for really huge salaries and quality salaries, just doesn't seem to be happening with the people in San Francisco. Our board of supervisors and the mayor have done a good job of making sure that we have a higher level of salary per hour payment than almost anybody else in California. They've made sure that you have a health component. In my conversation with Dennis Herrera a few days ago, when I read in the newspaper about how many restaurants had been collecting this money, if you go to a restaurant, you see they got a little deal down there, 4% health fee, and none of them are spending more than 1% health fee. And he went after them, and he collected a lot of money from a few of them, and he's got a lot more people to go after. But that's a good sign, because that means people are really focused and doing what needs to be done to make this the kind of quality city in which we would want to live, and we want to work, and we want to play. And so I'm proud of that, but we really do have to refocus our attention and try to figure out how to get the employment opportunities that are being generated by the decisions made by city planning and others for people in San Francisco. And then finally, we still have a city, however, that's more fascinated with, in some parts, more fascinated with process than with product. I had a major problem with many of the members of the Board of Supervisors when I served as mayor, because most of them were into the idea that they're better off if they just keep the process going rather than ultimately end it. Kind of like some of my fellow lawyers. I've got friends who are lawyers that say, you know, you have to go find a new client if you end this case. So let's just keep this case going. There's no reason why we ought to have to go find a new client. Well, some of the politicians were that way when I served, and some of those, they've graduated now. They're out in the private sector, moonlighting as principal people, but still doing nothing except trying their best to disrupt the orderly process. They don't believe in, they do not believe in full disclosure, ultimately. They do not believe in a whole series of things. On one area that I'm fascinated with, and that's one that people have been focused on for a long time, and it has to do with my personal interest, frankly, the 8 Washington. You read about that, you read some about it, and you know nothing about it. Literally, you know nothing about it because it has not been fully discussed. Hopefully, it's going to be fully discussed, and my guess is that you're going to embrace it the same way you've embraced the Giants baseball park, the same way you're going to embrace the Warriors arena, the same way you had embraced what happened in Mission Bay, the same way you have embraced what we have done with the Central Subway. You're going to embrace it because when the facts are told, the end result is going to be one that will be dramatic for the city, and it'll simply be a step and an improvement in the other process in the city. Finally, let me tell you, and you won't believe this, but I decided to find out what's happening with the pension systems. You know the pension systems throughout the nation and throughout the state of California and in the city and county of San Francisco are all facing some form of challenge. That seems to be somebody who thinks that you ought to be able to pay every benefit you need to pay to every possible person on every possible date. And so they do some scary things about what's happening with the pension system. Well, let me assure you that I don't think the pension system is in as bad a shape as everybody seems to think it is. But I did find out, as I moved around and asked questions, we have $13 billion in pension funds, public pension funds in San Francisco. Not one nickel of that $13 million is invested in San Francisco. None of these high-rises you see being built, none of the projects. We don't finance any of them. We hire a collection of people to advise us on what we should do and where we should finance, where we should invest our money for purposes of earning money, because you've got to earn money in order to avoid the need for tax dollars to go for pension benefits and health benefits to both retirees as well as their families to the extent we do it. And you would think with $13 billion, we ought to be looking for every opportunity for every good deal in this city to do as we're doing in other parts of the nation. The explanation given to me was very simple. We don't invest in San Francisco because we don't want the beneficiaries to know what we're investing in because they might oppose it. Well, I say the staff people who make those decisions ought to join Mr. Miller in his exit from the IRS. They ought to exit from our pension system because I genuinely believe the appropriate investment of pension funds ought to be where they bring the highest return, where they're consistent with really good judgment, where they're consistent with socially useful policies. But they clearly should not avoid the possibility of finding those opportunities in their own neighborhood for the people whose money they're actually managing. In this city, that is not the case. They actually have a policy of no investments in San Francisco, and I think at some point we really ought to challenge that. And so, as usual, I'm still looking for a cause. Thank you.
Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the noted political commentator, for his comments this evening. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions willing to ask you to address, but you said a great deal about national politics and San Francisco politics, but you didn't discuss the state. And so why don't you take a few minutes?
Well,
so,
I can...
Wait, Dana. Why don't you take a few minutes to talk about the state? And why don't we start by asking you to grade Governor Brown's performance as governor so far on a scale of A to F. Where does he fit?
On a scale of what?
A to F, as if you were giving him a grade.
A plus.
Okay. Would you explain why?
Well, because he's a solo act. The members of the legislature are not unlike our supervisors. They really are cooperating completely with everything Jerry Brown wishes to have happen. Jerry Brown is jumping at the opportunity for his vast experience to be employed, his greater firepower among talent that he has selected to be a part of his administration. He's taken over every significant issue that happens to be in place, and he's given a response to it, whether it's financing public education, whether it's dealing with the issues of how best to modify the prison system to comply with what the feds want us to do. He's addressing the issue of whether or not we're going to move water from north to south. He's addressing the issue of whether or not we're going to figure out how to move people expeditiously and effectively and safely in the year of 2035 and 2040 by the high-speed rail. He's doing so many incredibly imaginative things as well as ongoing things that he is just leaving in the dust all other politicians in the state of California. So you'd have to give him an A plus because there's nobody else in, you know, shouting distance.
Hey,
and therefore, which makes him uninteresting to talk about.
You've been an advisor to a number of governors. How would you compare Governor Brown to his predecessor, Governor Schwarzenegger, in both style and substance?
Well, obviously Schwarzenegger outstyled Jerry Brown. Schwarzenegger was about style and with the sprinkling of substance when required. Brown is about no style. At all, and all substance. And so that's the only way you can compare it. And you got to know that Arnold was my buddy. He still is my buddy and kind of my hangout buddy. Hanging out with Jerry means I don't know what it means.
Will the governor be able to control the supermajority as it proceeds to examine the need for new expenditures for a variety of causes?
He is totally and completely ignoring the supermajority or any of those respective numbers. He knows that whatever his program happens to be, he can produce it, whether it comes from a Democratic supermajority or whether it comes from a collection of Democrats and Republicans, period.
Okay. What do you think about his comment regarding the Bay Bridge when the issue of the bolts and the foundation when he said stuff happens, only used a different phrase than that?
That didn't surprise me because he served as governor at the time that the issue involving the bridge was being debated. And the two of us were very critical of every aspect of the decisions that were being made. We, of course, knew nothing about the bolts, any of that, but we knew that the people running Caltrans at the time really didn't know what they were doing, and they were not at all being imaginative the way people who built the Golden Gate Bridge had been, and we were very critical. And I, of course, was very concerned because there were no off-ramps to Treasure Island, which I said no bridge should be built without off-ramps to Treasure Island. Jerry wanted a different anchor for the East Bay so that it would afford an opportunity for great economic development in Oakland. So we were both very critical of the bridge. And Jerry is not going to take any responsibility for anything that has occurred subsequent to that. And so his comments, I think, were accurate.
Okay, thank you.
Because stuff does happen.
This question should be right up your alley. You've been a member of the Board of Trustees of the California State University System, with its 23 campuses and 350,000 students. You've been a regent for the University of California with its 10 campuses and 200,000 students. And you've been a member of the Board of Trustees of Dominican University with its 2 campuses and 2,500 students. Given the funding and performance challenges in today's environment for California's education system, what do you see in the immediate future? Particularly, does the California public university system need fundamental reorganization and change?
The system obviously needs fundamental reorganization and change. Governor Brown's father, Pat Brown, had in mind when the system was perfected. It was the 3-tiered system. It was the University of California that was supposed to be a research graduate institution focusing primarily on doctoral or graduate students and candidates. San Francisco, no, the state university system, which San Francisco State is a part of, my old institution, and it was supposed to play a role of filling in the gap between that and the community colleges. And 105 or so community colleges, theoretically, everybody was supposed to go to those schools for 2 years and then matriculate to the other 2 institutions with guaranteed seating capacity. That was never, ever complied with, and it's unfortunate that it wasn't complied with, because that system, I think, would have already answered many of the questions that we have and many of the challenges that we are facing. Obviously, education is more expensive now than it was when I went to school. I paid $50 a semester for law school. I paid nothing at San Francisco State University. It was virtually free, and free public education at the quality level is the way it really should be. And I'm hopeful that Governor Brown will turn his attention once he has taken care of the prisons and the 2 ditches, the 2 tunnels that he's building, has taken care of the high-speed rail and the financing of local school districts as he's attempting to do. I hope after he secures the 2nd term, on the way out the door, he will pick up where his father left off and do something about higher education. At this moment, optimism for a high school graduate in the state of California of being able to afford higher education is not good.
Thank you. One more question about the state, and then we'll move back to national politics. A former leading member of the legislature is positioning himself to run for governor, apparently, and he's focusing on crime, especially the relocation of inmates from the state to local prisons, or the fact that nonviolent prisoners are being released. He's opposed to that policy and wants to instead to build more prisons. What do you think of that position that the former lieutenant governor, I believe, is taking today?
Yeah, I think he's going to lose. Let's start with that. So I think he's going to say all kinds of crazy things that could never be implemented, even if he won. But he's totally and completely, in my opinion, out to lunch on that issue. The criminal justice system in California has become so overpopulated on the prison side, all because we changed the policies in this state to the detriment of the public in terms of cost, without any benefit on the safety side. I think if Jerry Brown ever turns his attention more than he has on the prison system, he is going to ask and offer the opportunity for every area of local government dealing with the system to go back and review every single solitary lifer that's there under the 3-strike laws and see whether or not the first 2 items that prompted their going to jail were in fact items that would prompt their going to jail, so that if not, then you pull those out. They no longer become lifers. They become individuals that can be transitioned out. When Daniel Boatwright, many years ago, in the late 70s, carried the law that got away from indeterminate sentencing in the state of California and went to fixed terms in the state of California, that was a bad thing. Because prisoners no longer were incentivized to, in fact, begin to get a high school diploma. in fact, began to get the training that, as meager as it might have been in the system, began to get that training to try to transition when they were released, because they could actually see good behavior, proper training, education, and all the other things that went on in the system could get them out of what could have been a very long sentence. That's no longer the case. 25 to life is 25 to life with all kinds of minimums, and it's all because you, the public, proceeded to say, we believe people ought to be locked up forever if they jaywalk. And as a result of that, the jaywalkers are overpopulated in our jails. Mr. Brown is taking the directions in part from pressure applied by the federal court and trying to find the jaywalkers and get them out of the prison system so we can begin to look at the system as we did before indeterminate sentences were abolished.
Okay, thank you. For those of you in the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest is Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and a political commentator on national and local issues, who's giving his take on the political arena in 2013. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Mr. Mayor, to many of his former supporters, the president has been somewhat of a disappointment recently. One of the weapons the president has in his quiver is the bully pulpit. Why is he not using that bully pulpit more often, and is he making a mistake by not doing so?
Well, I'm a supporter of Barack Obama, and you didn't mention that I do a column for the Chronicle and all the other things. That's important.
I'll try to remember if that goes on.
I don't get paid for this. I get paid for that. And so I want to advertise the fact that on Sunday you can read a column that can't be disputed. Because it's my version of the facts. And that's what you're reading, and you know that. I must tell you, though, that Barack Obama, on some occasions, has used the White House and the presidency in a way that the American people has admired and will admire. When he was going after the Republicans on the Obamacare issue, he used that pulpit, and he ended up winning the day with a great assist from Nancy Pelosi. And now the implementation process is reflecting itself. But he is a very deliberate person. He does not react nearly as swiftly as many of us in the world of politics react. And so he makes fewer mistakes. And his mistakes, when they are made, are usually smaller than the mistakes that many other politicians make regularly. I think that's the nature of the man. I think for all the years he's been alive and all of his training, and that's his discipline, I don't think you can alter that, nor do I think he should alter that. But I would hope that he would begin to see the necessity of forcing a fight. For an example, nothing could be more rewarding, in my opinion, on the gun control issue than to have a filibuster on that issue, because finally the world would see the ludicrous nature of the arguments being made by those who are lying through their teeth about why gun control should not occur. He would allow gun control to come out of the closet. I think he needs to make that kind of a decision on other issues similarly. He did an evolutionary thing when he went from a person who would shy away from standing next to Newsom in 2004, because Newsom had done same-sex marriages in San Francisco without public sanction and without people embracing it and without the political winds being right, to the point where he has become the great advocate some 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years later for that. So it takes this man a long time to evolve, but he will ultimately evolve. I just hope it's doing his second term.
Well, that sort of leads into the next question. Second terms for American presidents have been notorious because they produce so little in the way of success in domestic policy. That appears to be the case with Mr. Obama's presidency as well. Do you see his presidency going down that same path of little success in the domestic arena for the rest of his term?
No. We're only in the first year of his second term. And here's a guy that walked out of Iraq. He didn't say, mission accomplished, which was obviously a lie. Can you imagine, in the library in Dallas, they actually have that saying in Bush's one book library, mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. But Barack Obama got us out of Iraq. He's going to get us out of Afghanistan. I suspect that he's not going to allow us stupidly to go into Syria under the same circumstances as we did in Iraq. I likewise suspect that he's going to make sure that we avoid a confrontation with that kid in North Korea. I just think that you are going to see a spectacular performance in the second term by a talented leader, period, and just give him time.
Okay, thank you. One of the individuals in President Obama's cabinet who's taken a great deal of heat and is very controversial is the Attorney General Eric Holder. Many people have called for his resignation. How would you, what would you do to advise Eric Holder to stop moving on the path he's moving on now?
Well, you know, I have some personal clients that need his attention. My clients that run dispensaries for medicinal marijuana, they need Holder to say the state should have an opportunity through the vote of its people to determine whether or not that product by the prescription process is going to be available to people who may need it. He hasn't said that yet, so I'm a little annoyed that he hasn't said it. And I'm now wondering, though, that if he's about to leave, it won't cost him anything to say it. And so I'm urging him, hey, brother, if you're leaving, take care of the troops on the way out the door. On the other hand, I don't think he's going to leave at all, because I think that it would be almost impossible for Mr. Obama to get anybody of his quality, his talent, and his philosophy to be the Attorney General, since you've got to go through the approval process. I could see them doing to a new Attorney General candidate pushed by Mr. Obama what we did to Bork and what we did to Haynesworth and a few other nothings that never should have been considered for the Supreme Court, and what we should have done to Thomas, and we didn't do it. And I suspect that Mr. Obama is going to be wise enough to know that he's got the best attorney general that he could ever get, and that Holder, as attorney general, will be making decisions reflective of an equal justice system. And that's important. And so I hope Holder stays there, whether he takes care of my marijuana guys or not.
Gee, I thought the best attorney general was the one in the state of California.
Well, I share your view that, but that's the state attorney general, and I think she is going to make a fabulous governor if and when she runs for governor. And then after that, I don't know what her future will hold, but I can see the governorship, and then it may be something beyond that. I think she's just that talented.
Okay, thank you. You raised the issue of 2016 and mentioned the fact that Hillary Clinton seemed to have a lock on the nomination. Both she and her most potential rival, Joe Biden, will both be in their early 70s, if I remember correctly, at the time. Who are the up-and-coming younger Democrats who might be interested in the presidency?
Well, at this stage of the game, I don't think that any of the other Democrats will evidence any interest in the presidency. I think there will be some interest shown in the vice presidency. For one example, the governor of Massachusetts will obviously be a guy that you'd have to take a second look at if you were a candidate for president and you were looking for a running mate. There's a mayor of Atlanta, Georgia, whom you've got to take a second look at. And there are several newly minted and elected U.S. senators that you've got to take a look at closely as possible future candidates for national office. But I don't think any of them will allow themselves to be pitted against Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden.
Thank you. Unfortunately, Mr. Mayor, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. During your second term as mayor, you had a rather tumultuous relationship with the Board of Supervisors. Is it true that you coined the term Board of Stupidvisors?
I did not coin that term. That term was coined by a columnist who passed on in 1997 in February. His name was Herb Cain.
Thank you. Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the Speaker of the State Assembly and noted political commentator who writes for this San Francisco Chronicle every Sunday. We also thank our audiences here and on radio and television and the Internet. I'm Joseph Fink, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.